It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday. We'll get advice on pickling all those cucumbers and other produce showing up this month.
But first, the Washington Post reports that the National Security Agency, or NSA, broke privacy rules thousands of times a year since being granted broader powers in 2008. This information comes from a review of top-secret documents leaked by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden.
According to the report, these breaches range from significant law violations to typographical errors that resulted in unintended interceptions of emails and phone calls.
Joining us to discuss this news is Quinn Norton, a blogger and journalist whose work has been published in Wired, The Atlantic, and other publications. Quinn, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, to be clear, these top secret documents are internal audit reports of the NSA, correct?
Yes.
So tell us briefly about what kinds of infractions were found in those documents.
Well, a lot of what we're seeing in those documents are over-collection or improper collection. For instance, one of the typographic ones was putting in the DC area code instead of the country code for Egypt. And intercepting a bunch of phone calls that way. I actually think that that we don't know quite the shape of a lot of these things or the extent, because we're not looking at any kind of rigorous oversight system. This is just, I feel like the door has cracked, and we're kind of seeing that thin glimpse into the room via this internal audit report.
Mm. So what does it say about the Obama administration's reassurances earlier this month that the NSA's electronic surveillance programs are tightly regulated?
I mean, he said on Friday Friday last week, mm-hmm. That he was comfortable that there was no abuse. And I think that just to put straight out there what that was a lie. And given the timeline of when they were responding to the Barton Gellman's article, they probably, can't say for sure, but probably had already known that this was coming out, which makes it, to my mind, not only a lie, but a kind of tactically questionable one. I don't really understand the administration's thinking on immediately saying there's no abuse of the system right before a big news report about all the thousands of abuses in the system coming out.
Well, one of the issues was that these documents showed more detail and analysis than what was actually shared with the Justice Department. So, in other words, the NSA, it doesn't sound like the NSA reported all of these details the same way they did others. So do you think that this information ever would have come to light if Edward Snowden hadn't have leaked these documents to The Washington Post?
No, I don't see how they could have.
And do you have any, I guess, would you speculate on as to why they didn't report these errors?
Well, the court has already said that they don't actually have much in the way of ability to enforce their oversight. The court does not have an investigative body that goes in and audits the NSA. They're entirely relying on self-report. And I think what you see in any kind of large organization with many employees is that eventually, you know, you're kind of ducking the oversight because the oversight's time consuming. You could get in trouble. It's a very human instinct to just kind of, you know, duck the class monitor.
Well, I imagine that if you think, say that this was an honest mistake, I didn't mean to punch in the country or the area code for Washington, D.C., but rather the country code for Egypt. Whoops, it was an honest mistake. Could that have been a reason why this information wasn't shared?
Well, certainly incidental collection is not part of this data set. That is not considered like things that are accidentally swept in and the metadata, things accidentally swept in and not really looked at by an analyst and the metadata. That's not part of this. That's not considered problematic in this way. The other thing that's absent in this report is, as near as we can tell looking at it, is any intentional abuse. This is all mistakes. So whether or not the mistakes are kind of entering into the realm of like a Fourth Amendment violation, or if they're just considered operational mistakes that don't actually violate any laws, that latter category is not in this. The former category is, but there's no indication of intentional abuse. And I find that particularly troubling because in any organization, it's very large, whether it's Microsoft or Google or certainly government agencies, there's always a few people who go off the reservation, they do something, they stalk their ex-girlfriend, whatever, and there's usually some sort of oversight and disciplinary measure, but you just have that problem in large organizations. The fact that that isn't here at all just makes me think we haven't seen those numbers yet.
So what kind of oversight systems are in place to find that kind of abuse if it exists, and what would be done about it?
Well, the NSA has said that they have over 300 people working on this problem, but they haven't told us anything about how they're working on this problem. And they're also working on it with an interpretation of the law that is still classified. So whether or not they consider what they consider illegal or legal is not known to us. The procedures that those 300 people are following to find intentional and unintentional abuse are not known to us. We just have this one little bit, and in that little bit, we have thousands of violations. It's a troubling situation to be in.
So if these abuses have been allegedly taking place since 2008, can we speculate that there might have been more prior to that, and how would we ever find out for sure?
Well, certainly, there's been some whistleblowing about Stellar Wind, which was the mass collection before 2008. We don't know anything about the oversight system that was on Stellar Wind, if there was any. They were ready to roll out mass surveillance before, according to the whistleblowers Drake and Binney. They actually had a lot of this infrastructure in place before September 11th, and they were ready to roll out domestic surveillance basically the day that it happened. And I think one of the things that's important to bear in mind is that if you've got an agency that's information collectors, that's people who like to collect information, and they're going to over-collect if they get the chance because it's what they're good at. And that's why oversight and transparency are so important in these systems. But we don't really have any functional oversight. If the body that is supposed to be overseeing the NSA, and that body has existed, the FISA court has existed since the 1970s, has nothing but self-report, then it doesn't seem to me that we have any assurance that there has been good oversight even before these problems in 2008. There's got to be more reports somewhere, but we don't have access to them.
Well, lawmakers are already calling for reforms today and for greater transparency in NSA operations. Do you think that this could be a turning point in accountability?
Well, one of the things, Obama made it clear in his August 9th press conference that he had no intention of calling for or cooperating with efforts to stop mass collection, to stop the collection of Americans' phone data, these sorts of things, just to try and get Americans to be more comfortable with it. And at that point, as I say, I think there's a good chance that they already knew that that this Washington Post piece was on the way. So I think that the executive is digging its heels in. I don't know what it takes to be a turning point. The executive has a lot of power in this situation. Obama, the DOJ, the military, they've all got a very entrenched infrastructure. And I think it might call for a revolt from Congress to upset that Congress may not at this point be politically capable of.
So you've been following this story closely. In just a minute or so, what additional insights do you have to share about this issue?
This the thing that I always go on about is that we do have some power as individuals by using encrypted communication. Using encrypted communication does mean that the NSA keeps our communications actually indefinitely compared to having to destroy them if we are known American persons, but it does mean that if they want to dig into the mass communications of people, they have to put a lot of money and a lot of people and a lot of computers on doing it. And I think making our privacy more expensive is something that everyone in America can actually push towards doing right now. So I just encourage people to respond to this news by securing their own information and thinking about their own privacy and learning about encryption tools.
Well, thank you for being with us, Quinn.
Thank you for having me.
That was Quinn Norton, a journalist whose work has been published in Wired, The Atlantic, and other publications. She joins us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco.
Coming up next, We Can Pickle That. We'll speak with Jennifer McKenzie, author of The Complete Book of Pickling, about what to do with all our produce. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This time of year, there's an abundance of cucumbers at farmers markets and in gardens around Wisconsin.
One way to keep up with the cucumber storm is to make pickles. Here to explain the process is Jennifer McKenzie, professional home economist and author of The Complete Book of Pickling, 250 recipes from pickles and relishes to chutneys and salsas. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
All right, so what's the basic pickle? We take our cucumber and do what to it?
Well, you need to add vinegar. That's what pickling's all about. And anything that is lower in acid, like a cucumber, in order to preserve it, you need to add vinegar. So there's all different formulations. Some of them have sugar. Some of them have spices. And then, of course, there's the classic dill pickle. And, yeah, so basically you need a balanced recipe. So it can't, you don't want it too vinegary so that you can't eat it. But you need enough vinegar to make sure you're preserving it.
So why do you soak the cucumbers in salt before you put them in the pickling liquid?
Well, some of them, some techniques that use that technique, and what you're doing, you're drawing out the natural water from the cucumber, so you're getting rid of that. The salt draws that out, and then that way you can get more of the wonderful pickling brine that you've made with your vinegar and your sugar and your seasoning that goes right into the cucumber. So you're essentially exchanging the liquid in the cells of the cucumber, and that helps to preserve them, and it helps to flavor them, all that delicious pickle flavor.
And do you need to heat those guys?
Yes, definitely. I always recommend doing the hot water bath. So once you've filled your jars, you use a hot pickling liquid. Sometimes you pack the cucumbers in cold. Sometimes you heat them up. But you add the hot pickling liquid in your hot jars, and then you immerse them in a boiling water canner. So everybody's seen those big canners with the racks in them and then those two-piece lids. And that's what I call insurance. And I know there's lots of grandmas out there who have never done the boiling water canner, but it basically it creates a vacuum seal, so you don't get any thing going into the jar you don't want, and it also destroys any microorganisms that might be in the jar, and then it preserves them so that you can have wonderful, delicious pickles that that won't go bad on the shelf.
So what kind of spices are we adding to it to get the flavors that we want? What would you recommend?
Well, dill is obviously a classic, and I don't know about your gardens, but the gardens right now, the dill heads are those big flowers, and you can use the dill seeds and the feathery fronds from the dill, and that adds a very classic flavor. I like to add sometimes some mustard seeds or garlic for sure in some of the dill pickles. And then if you're talking about bread and butter pickles, one of my favorite combinations is a bit of sugar. They're a little bit sweeter. Some mustard seeds, celery seeds, and a tiny bit of curry powder. And that's what I think makes a perfect bread and butter pickle.
I used to do a fair amount of canning. I haven't lately. My one biggest failure is when I tried to make pickles, I used this random spice mix that obviously wasn't intended for cucumber pickles, it turned out. And two, they were mushy. I mean, they were just like really, mouthfeel if you're a wine person. It just was all wrong, man. What did I do wrong? What makes for a mushy pickle?
Well, sometimes it was the cucumber's fault. It wasn't your fault at all. Sometimes if a cucumber is drying out or it's kind of, sometimes they get that punky texture just if the growing season wasn't good or if they were picked too long. You want to get your cucumbers either from the farmer's market or from the farm or from your garden and pickle them as soon as possible after harvesting, because if they tend to, if they start to dry out, they're sort of punky and they get that mushy texture, and also if the vinegar balance isn't correct. So some people added alum or grape leaves or something to keep them crispy, but I find if you just have the right balance of vinegar, so use a tested recipe, and use your really fresh cucumbers. And one of the ways to check your cucumbers, if they're the right texture, put them in a big sink of water, and if they float, they're too dry, and they won't make good pickles. You want them to be heavy and sink.
Well, I like blame the pickles, or blame the cucumber.
Blame the cucumbers,
that's a good motto. So how long does it take to pickle something? Is this an all-day project or just a couple hours?
It all depends. Sometimes some of them are really quick. There's my classic quick dill pickles, and those ones you just heat up the vinegar, sugar, water, and the dill, and then you put the cucumbers into the jars cold. So those ones you just pack them into the jars, you pour in the hot liquid, and then they're only in the canner for about 15 minutes. So you could certainly do it in the morning. Some of them are sort of over 2 days, the ones that you soak with the salt. Either they're sliced ones or whole, and you soak them overnight with the salt, and that draws out the water, and then the next day. But it's certainly not two full days of work by any means. And then there's other ones. If you're going to ferment them, then you have them, you know, down in your cellar for, you know, a couple of weeks, and those are a little more time consuming. But you can get a nice batch of pickles or two in a half a day.
Now, you send us a recipe. We've got it up on the Central Time Facebook page. Dill pickles they're cut into chips, like for sandwiches. What's the idea behind the recipe? Anything else special about that one?
Well, you know, I love my bread and butter pickles, and I don't think that you can have a grilled cheese sandwich without the bread and butters. And those are a sort of a sweeter style, but a lot of people just love their dill cucumbers. And one of the things I found with this recipe, when you get the dill pickles and you want to make the little baby dills and with the whole pickles, if you've got some that are a little bit too big, you only get three or four in a jar, and that seems to be a bit of a waste of time. So if you slice them up into thin slices, either lengthwise or crosswise, and then make these dilly pickles, cucumber chips, you can pack a lot more in the jar. You can use up those slightly bigger cucumbers, and they're already pre-sliced for your sandwiches and burgers. So they're like the style of a bread and butter pickle by the looks of them, but they still have that lovely dill flavor.
Well, now I, for one, have a small kitchen and old appliances, electric appliances. So when I hear about canning, the first thing I think is, this is not for me. I can't do it. Can you give me and others with small kitchens and old appliances a pep talk?
Well, and you know what's so funny? I have the smallest kitchen. Even for what I do, people walk in, they're like, really? This is your kitchen? I have it. It's efficient, I call it. And you know what? If you can bring a pot of water to boil on your stove, so as long as it functions that well and you can bring a pot of water to boil, it doesn't matter. You don't have to have the fancy appliances. I do have a big canning pot because you do need a pot that the jars fit in with an inch or two of water above them. So you need a deep pot, but you don't have to buy a fancy canner or anything. And they're actually really economical because they're not even as good as sort of my regular cooking pots. They're just a thinner but a big kettle. But you can just use a deep pot, and if you use the shorter jars, like the pint jars, your pot doesn't even have to be too deep. So you can use regular equipment. I really do like my canning equipment that I have the special funnel and I have the tongs, but you can get those sort of at hardware stores and home stores really economically just if you're going to be doing any canning. And then, of course, buy the good quality canning jars and the two-piece lids. You can reuse the jars, and that's no problem as long as they have no cracks. But you want to buy the new lids, the little inserts, every year just to make sure you have the best seal.
Now, you're talking to people in Wisconsin here, and we'll eat pickled anything.
Oh,
what are some of your favorite non-cucumber things to pickle?
Non-cucumbers. Well, pickled beans. I love my pickled beans. Green beans, yellow beans, wax beans. And pickled carrots are really yummy. I actually have a dill pickle carrot recipe, and that one's really easy because, again, you just bring the liquid to a boil, and you cut your carrot sticks, and you put them in the jars, and they're really delicious. And pickled peppers, hot peppers, of course. I don't know, do you eat any hot dogs or sausages out there? Because hot dogs and sausages with pickled peppers are delicious. And then I'm a big chutney fan. So chutney is basically a whole bunch of stuff chopped up and then pickled, and usually some sugar and some vinegar. And peach chutney is probably one of my favorite things. Oh, and salsa. I love salsa.
Maybe a wacky salsa tip to leave us with, because in addition to all the cucumbers, I know the tomatoes are hitting this week.
The tomatoes are hitting, yes. One of the things I like to do, I like to peel my tomatoes before I make my salsa, and I like to hand chop my tomatoes. Some people use a food processor to make it faster, but peeling the tomatoes, it gives it sort of a nicer texture. It's a bit tedious. You'd blanch the tomatoes in hot water and then plunge them into cold water and peel them. And one thing I really like is the plum tomatoes or the Roma tomatoes, because then you can, you don't have to boil the tomato salsa as long, because the big beefsteak tomatoes have a lot of water in them, but you get a more intense flavor if you use the Roma tomatoes.
And for blanching and peeling those tomatoes, I remember back in the day, my favorite piece of kitchen equipment was my tomato shark. It was like a melon baller, but with serrated edge. Do you use that?
Look, you know what? I don't have one of those, but I have used them. Yeah, to pluck out the little core.
Yeah.
That, if you still have one, that would come in very handy.
That made a big difference. Wow. Well, Jennifer, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, thanks for getting in touch, and happy pickling.
That was Jennifer McKenzie, professional home economist. Her book is The Complete Book of Pickling, 250 recipes from pickles and relishes to chutneys and salsas. You can share your favorite pickling preserving, canning, salsa making stories at the Central Time Facebook page.
And your recipes and pep talks.
Mm, definitely.
For those with small kitchens.
And catch the Joy Cardine Show, too, next Thursday at 6. Joy and her guests are going to talk about canning. So don't miss that.
Yeah. If you want to hear more about preserving the summer harvest, like I said, a Joy Cardine Show is next week. Coming up Monday on Central Time, we'll talk to a guest from the American Lung Association in Wisconsin about e-cigarettes. We'll also talk about what they are, why they're so popular, and if they help smokers quit.
And we're going to get the science behind sinkholes. We've seen some of those in the news lately. That's coming up Monday on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We talked to Senator Ron Johnson yesterday about the Affordable Health Care Act. He supports repealing that law. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk to a supporter of the law who will make the case for sticking with it. That's coming up after 4.
But first, if you're a Wisconsin history buff, you might have visited Old World Wisconsin. The combination of heirloom gardens and recreations of farmsteads and villages allow a visitor to step back in time and get a glimpse of what life was like in the 19th century.
But according to our next guest, the creation of Old World Wisconsin wasn't easy. He says the site was plagued by limited funds, bureaucratic tangles, and low public support. Well, despite that, Old World Wisconsin was built. It's one of the largest outdoor museums of rural life in the U.S.
John Krugler is a professor of history at Marquette University, and his new book is Creating Old World Wisconsin, The Struggle to Build an Outdoor History Museum of Ethnic Architecture. John, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you. I'm very glad to be here.
Well, for someone who's never been to Old World Wisconsin before, how would you describe it?
Well, for history buffs, certainly it's a fascinating place because they have collected 67 buildings from throughout Wisconsin that were very much in danger of being destroyed either by a farmer who no longer wanted them on his property or just simply by falling victim to decay and being ignored. And so, it's a on a 576-acre property, and it is quite a visit, especially if it were a day like today to be out there and walking those gravel roads and visiting the German farmsteads and the Finnish and Norwegian and so forth and the Crossroad Village. So it is a place where one can go out there for enjoyment and enjoying nature. They have nature trails, but it's also a place where you can learn about the families who inhabited these houses and worked in the barns and so forth out at Old World Wisconsin.
Hmm. Now, you've noted that that Old World Wisconsin was sort of a mysterious, had a mysterious history and that little attention was paid to the origins and development of the museum. Why do you think that was?
Well, I think it's like so many things. Time passed it by as it had was doing to the houses that were rescued. And what I found is in my many trips out there is many people knew some of the story, but nobody knew the whole story of Old World Wisconsin's origins. So I set out as my task to write that story. I was principally fueled by having done an interview with Professor William Tischler at the University of Wisconsin in the Landscape Architecture Department. I interviewed him in 1993 and 1994, and he told me this fascinating story about how he created the master plan for the museum using first 12 undergraduate students. And as a history professor, I found it fascinating that he could get so much work out of those 12 students. And then the next year he refined it using three graduate students, and they produced a plan that was accepted by the Board of Curators in October of 1968.
So I'm wondering if you think, I'll make an assumption. You tell me how valid you think it is. You mentioned that it was hard to get off the ground because time sort of passed by. Do you find that there's a general lack of appreciation for recent history and that we don't start to, think about preserving old things until it's just almost too late?
Well, let me answer that question in a kind of a roundabout way. In order to understand the Old World Wisconsin story, you had to go back at least 50 years in Wisconsin's history and even more. In 1945, we emerged victoriously from a very draining war. It had pushed our resources to the absolute limit, and people throughout the nation had been on wartime rationing, and certainly that was true in Wisconsin. And as the economy began to prosper and pick up, one of the things that happened is more and more people wanted to build houses. And as they began to move into the countryside, these older houses became eyesores. They were standing in the way of what we might call progress. And in 1960, a Milwaukee architect by the name of Richard W. E. Perrin decided that he could no longer stand to see houses torn down, barns torn down, and so forth. And so after 30 years in the field, he had come to the conclusion that these resources were disappearing too quickly. And so he approached the Wisconsin Historical Society in 1960, and that's what began this effort to salvage or rescue buildings from throughout Wisconsin. And that's where most of my story picked up in terms of what this meant for the society. It had great impact on the society, but it was in many ways a naive but courageous decision on the part of the society to take on a task that was far beyond its means to be able to accomplish.
Hmm. Well, how did they manage to do it?
Well, they did it by relying on volunteers, which in any public institution is a vital part of how they get things done. They co-opted professionals, and they relied on society staff. And then they had to find ways to raise money. And perhaps the saddest part of the tale is that they were so ineffective in raising the amount of money that was needed. The original projections for the cost of the museum were far under what the actual cost became, and so they had to struggle to find enough money. But the biggest problem they had was simply finding a place to build this museum. And so when Perrin approached Leslie Fischel, the seventh director of the society in 1960, he was cautious, but he authorized his sites director to investigate it and come up with possible ways that they could apply to foundations to get money. But then he set out to find a site for it, and the site that became the favorite was the State Forest at Eagle. And beginning in 1962 and stretching out for another decade, the State Historical Society struggled to get that site. The land, most of it was land owned by the Department of Natural Resources, and you would think, well, that won't be hard to get it transferred over to another state agency, but that was quite incorrect, and so it took 10 years to get the land. The second big challenge they faced was how to get a master plan, and they didn't have enough money to go out and hire a professional, so they turned to a young assistant professor who had just arrived 2 years before at the University of Wisconsin Landscape Architecture Department, and he was recommended by his department head. He said, yes, we have a new appointee here who is very interested in old buildings, and that was the only qualification that he really had. And he was able to turn this into a master plan that laid out, in general terms, where the sites would be. So that was a major hurdle that had to be overcome. And then there would be many other smaller ones, but the next biggest one would be fundraising. And it's here that they were not able to get the support from people throughout the state that they had envisioned. Wisconsin Historical Society is unique in many respects, especially from Eastern historical societies. It's very much more a democratic, that's a small D, operation, and depends highly on citizen support. And so the leaders of the society thought, well, we'll just call upon the people for our support. But they were never able to marshal that campaign for money, and they were not able to excite people's imagination. And that's kind of ironic and sad because the people who worked on the project were so excited about it, and they had this vision of what the museum could become. But because of the lack of financial support, then they had to trim back. And so the museum we have today is considerably smaller than what was originally envisioned.
How much of the difficulty in fundraising and getting that initial support had to do with the fact that this was a proposal for an open-air museum, which was not something that was terribly common?
Well, you're right. You're quite right there. Not only was it difficult to attract interest in terms of fundraising, but it was also sailing in uncharted waters as far as the State Historical Society. Most of the big museums that had been built prior to this were run out of the pocketbooks of individuals like Henry Ford at Greenfield Village and Rockefellers at Williamsburg and the Wells family at Old Sturbridge Village, the Lilly Foundation at Conner Prairie. And so they had very, very important resources that they could call upon, but the State Historical Society didn't have this kind of person, and so they had to try to engender interest in fundraising. They organized a campaign, but unfortunately it got started way too late, and so the museum opened on June 30th, 1976, but it was not ready to open, I think would be the safest way. The director of the museum actually argued internally that they shouldn't open on that date, but they had promised to get it open on the, before the 4th of July, which was the 200th anniversary of the American bicentennial of the Revolutionary War. So they were able to bring that about in that fashion, but it was a continual struggle to make that work, and part of it was the society wasn't set up for fundraising, for a major fundraising campaign. But again, here's where the lack of money in the society's part hurt them. They could not afford to go out and hire a professional fundraising organization to organize the a campaign, and so they depended on the Board of Curators, which is responsible for management of the society, and then whatever they could drum up through volunteer supporters. And the total cost of the museum just kept increasing, and the amount of fundraising was not nearly enough to meet the needs of the museum. And so increasingly they had to turn to the state for public support, and the state was very reluctant to pour big bucks into Old World Wisconsin. But going back to your question about the newness, when they started on the project, they didn't know what they were doing. I mean, quite literally, there was no textbooks on how to build a museum. They had to learn as they went along. And so one of the most remarkable developments that I found in this museum was how they were able to take raw recruited workers, with some specialty, and they began to learn as they went along. Bill Tischler, I think, is a wonderful example of that. He had no experience in museums. He was a landscape architect. He wasn't a historian. He wasn't a building architect, but he learned as he went along. He taught students, and what resulted there in the master plan was a remarkable conceptual plan for the museum. They did this in so many other ways. They had the first chairman of the Board of Curators Committee was a man named Fitzgerald from Milwaukee. Norman Fitzgerald was a Milwaukee businessman, and he had no background in museums. He didn't have any idea of what he was getting in, but he became very enthused. He was co-opted. He bought into the excitement. The next chair that succeeded him was Roger Extell, who was the vice president of Parker Pen Company in Janesville. He had no experience, but he had, again, this excitement, this drive, and that's what literally drove this museum to creation was the volunteers were so excited about working on this project that, you know, they carried it along at times when it was about to, you know, go the way of the dodo bird. So,
well, John, that's a lot of passion driving the creation of Old World Wisconsin. We're talking with John Krugler about his new book, Creating Old World Wisconsin. You can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Have you been to Old World Wisconsin? Perhaps you've wondered about its history, how it came to be. We'll continue our discussion and take your calls after the break. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. We are talking with John Krugler. He's professor of history at Marquette University and author of Creating Old World Wisconsin, The Struggle to Build an Outdoor History Museum of Ethnic Architecture. And we invite you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. John, you mentioned the park had opened in 1976, and by then a lot of the 19th century buildings that have been put on the site were a good 100 years old or so. Can you talk about where the buildings come from and how they got there?
Well, some of the buildings came from as far away as Bayfield County, way up around Lake Superior. Many of them came from Dodge County and others from Mequon and Waukesha County was able to supply some. The construction crew didn't know what the inventory was of historic buildings in Wisconsin. One of the things that the Historical Society tried to put together was this inventory, but again, lack of money, prevented them from going out and really doing a thorough search for these historic houses. And so they were kind of going out in the field and finding these houses pretty much on their own. And so they scouted primarily from the southern part of Wisconsin, but they did have a considerable number of trips up into Bayfield County, for example. So they tried to get buildings from all over the state, and they were especially interested in having a representation for all of the ethnic groups. I think there were something like 42 different ethnic groups that came to Wisconsin, and so the master plan even had a location for an Icelandic exhibit. And I didn't even know there were Icelandic people who came to Wisconsin, but in trying to be as comprehensive as possible, they included them. There were Welsh, just a great many ethnic groups. Now, unfortunately, the Germans, the Finns, the Norwegians, and to a lesser extent the Danes and Poles are the major groups represented in Old World Wisconsin. There are some additional Czech shoemaker in the village, of Irish washerwoman in the village, and so forth. But because of the lack of funds, they had to dramatically draw back on what they could do. And so it's a far reach from what was envisioned to have all of Wisconsin's ethnic groups represented. But the objective, or the original goal, was to stretch their net as far as they could in Wisconsin. And they had one home from Brilliant, Wisconsin, for example, that was brought to Old World, but it was in such bad shape they couldn't reconstruct it. So this was an indication how far they were reaching out for their buildings.
Well, you know, this is probably a complicated question, but if you could answer it briefly, how did you get the houses from Bayfield down to One World, Wisconsin, all presumably in one piece and in good condition?
Well, your presumption that they were in one piece is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
What the crews had to do up in Bayfield County and other places was to meticulously deconstruct the house and to take it apart piece by piece. And so many of the buildings were transported in pieces like this on large trucks. Some were moved fully intact. For example, St. Peter's Church was moved in two pieces. And the Waterville store that came later was moved in one piece. So sometimes they could move a building intact. Kepsel House and the Turek House, which were major German buildings that they wanted, had to be completely dismantled. And, of course, in the process of dismantling a building, you can't preserve everything. Generally, they never tried to preserve the roof, but many parts of the building simply could not be salvaged because they were in such a state of decay. And the Kepsel House is a Fock work or half-timber house that was in Jackson, Wisconsin, near the Jackson Marsh. And it was according to Mr. Perrin, one of the very best examples of this Pomeranian architecture. But it had fallen into such decay by 1960. The farmer that eventually owned the property built a new house, and so he cut a big hole in the side of the building for a truck entrance. The roofs were collapsing. The windows were broken. And so it was impossible to salvage the whole product, the original fabric. And so the house that exists at Old World, Wisconsin, is maybe 50% of the original fabric. There's no way to know for sure, but they had to make concessions to modern times. For example, the Kepsel House was never built to have the number of people coming through, and so they had to put in a foundation and then put steel beams across it to support it. All the boards were termited, treated and so forth. It wouldn't have been done in the original house, but for the most part, they simply had to take them down and then bring back to Old World, reassemble them. So it was like constantly dealing with a giant puzzle.
Wow, sounds like it. Well, let's take a call from Julie in Mazomani. Hi, Julie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. First thing I want to do is just thank the Historical Society and the state of Wisconsin for having such a commitment to an outdoor museum like this, because Old World, Wisconsin really gives people the chance to hands-on experience what our ancestors went through 75 years ago, 100 years ago, 150 years ago. And with that said, my husband and I, 25 years ago, took our own kids out there several times, and the kids were able to be involved in taking on a first-person character, actually doing living history there, having the chance to experience history and teach the public. And then 2 weeks ago, you know, fast forwarding 25 years, I had the opportunity to take my own grandkids out there to do the same thing. So, you know, in my opinion, it is a day well spent. It's a commitment well spent, and I'm very grateful it exists.
Nice. Well, thank you for sharing that, Julie. John, I'm wondering,
part of what the problem about the story I wrote was a preservation movement. They wanted to preserve these buildings, and that's what they focused on. The more difficult task came as the museum opened was, how do we interpret this? How do we reach out to people? And that's a whole other story.
Mm-hmm.
But now they have very much tried to develop programs that get people much more involved in doing history, so they're learning history by doing things.
Do you think that the old world of Wisconsin of today resembles the original vision of the museum?
Only to a very limited extent. The original museum would have been much bigger and represented many, many more ethnic groups. What has been accomplished is incredibly significant. The State Historical Society, probably if Leslie Fischel, the director, had made a conscious business decision, he would have said, "Oh, I'm sorry these buildings are disappearing, but we're not the vehicle. We don't have the money to do this." But rather, he committed the society to looking into this, and eventually, step by step, the curators endorsed the plan, and they were able to proceed with this. Now, one of the problems that I talk about extensively is the town of Eagle resisted the museum coming very vigorously, and so they had to spend nearly a year in legal battles with the town of Eagle. So not everybody welcomed this idea that Julie mentioned, you know, this great idea. They didn't think it was a great idea. So they had to expend a considerable amount of resources fighting part of the local community over this.
So talk in just our last 30 seconds here about, you know, what is the value to you to be able to experience a living history museum like this?
Well, for me, I love going out to these places and seeing these older buildings and hearing what they have to say about them. But I think for people who aren't historians, it's a great way for people to be introduced to a museum like this. And many people think Old World Wisconsin is a children's museum. It's an adult museum, and adults should come out there and see what it has to offer and learn the stories of these immigrants who came to Wisconsin. And Richard Perrin wanted to call it New World Wisconsin. I think that would have been a much better title, because what we're seeing out there is how people came, immigrant families came from all over Europe, and they came to Wisconsin, and they had to battle the climate, and they had to battle trees, every conceivable problem, and they succeeded. And so Old World is telling that story about how groups of people from Germany or Poland or Finland or Sweden came to the United States and were able to create an existence, a new existence for themselves. And so that's what's been encapsulated here in the buildings.
Well, thank you, John, for telling us about it. We are actually out of time. That was John Krugler, a professor of history at Marquette University, and his new book is Creating Old World Wisconsin, The Struggle to Build an Outdoor History Museum of Ethnic Architecture. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.